Okay. All right, guys. So everybody's refreshed. Excellent. I'm going to give my 10-minute talk now. I'm going to talk about the work that's been going on in my lab. Let's see. So as we all know, all of us here, it's quite a good time to be bilingual, I would say. So there are a number of claims about bilingualism that suggest that it enhances cognitive function over the lifespan. So Ellen Bialystok and colleagues have been a great champion of this idea. There's been some suggestion that it may delay the onset of cognitive decline in conditions like Alzheimer's disease, or it might delay cognitive decline during normal healthy aging. And one might wonder, how is this all possible? And one of the main idea of how this might be all possible is the idea that cross-language competition, which we know is rampant in people who have to juggle more than one language at a time, that this might, the very act of this might act as an agent of change across the lifespan, of neuroplastic change across the lifespan. Now, of course, as of now, this hypothesis about bilingualism is really, we're still at the level of a hypothesis, right? So there have been many questions still remain about this. So there have been some non-replications, there have been some conditions on when these effects emerge, and so on and so forth. And what I tend to think is that this is really a very hard question to ask, right? Because if you're comparing large groups of bilinguals, whole groups of bilinguals against whole groups of monolinguals, there are so many ways that these two groups can differ that might impact this. And we heard about some of that in the last talk. So, for example, Denise Klein showed us that the brain responds to being bilingual differently depending on how when the second language is acquired, right? So there are lots of moving parts here that I fear might lead to the situation where you find group differences you don't. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. So there are a number of open questions. So the first that I've been interested, my students are interested in our research, and the first one is there a link between cognitive control and bilingual language processing among bilinguals? That is, can we somehow begin to characterize the way bilinguals differ in terms of how they process language as a function of history and ability and things of this sort? And can we find links, differential patterns of links to cognitive control or inhibitory function under these circumstances? So, and why is this interesting? Well, because presumably this is the mechanism of these bilingual advantages, right? And, of course, there are also standard models of bilingual language processing. So, for example, David Green's inhibitory control model, which ascribe an important position, an important place for inhibitory control in how bilinguals manage their two languages. Okay, so another kind of question that we're interested in my lab is how do bilinguals and monolinguals balance the demands of comprehension and production across several key linguistic domains, right? So we know that that cognitive control is required not just of bilinguals, but it's also required of monolinguals, right? But doing language and successfully using language is a multifaceted process, and there are many aspects of language that are underdetermined, that are ambiguous, where we have to use context to control activation of one meaning or another. So we know that language in general taxes cognitive control abilities. So, but what is it about the bilingual situation that may be similar or different to what monolinguals do that might give bilinguals this edge? So we study language in L1 and L2 language processing across a number of domains, such as just how do people process words, language production, emotional word processing, and formulaic language. So I'm just going to give you a flavor of the kinds of things that we do in my lab and highlight some studies here and there. Okay. So generally speaking, the methods that we've been using in the past few years have really focused heavily on eye movement measures of comprehension and production. Eye movement measures of language processing are incredibly versatile, right? So you can use it not just to study reading, but you can use eye movement measures to get get a handle on the processes involved in spoken word recognition and in production, depending on your experimental setup. And one of the really neat things about eye movement studies of language processing is that typically they're very natural, right? The thing that the participant is doing at any point in time is just processing language the way you or I would process language out and about in the world, right, as opposed to having a secondary decision or task that's kind of unnatural. The other thing that's really good about eye movement measures of language processing is that they're highly temporally sensitive. So unlike lexical decision responses or other kinds of button press tasks where the reaction times are often quite long, eye movements are immediate. So you can get an immediate sense of what's going on and what language users do when they process language using eye movement measures. We use other types of methods in the lab. One of my graduate students, Naveed, is now undertaking an ERP study. Another student in the lab who is co-supervised with Sherry Baum is interested in using TMS. And as Denise mentioned before, we're trying to do some structure-function correlations using MRI. Now, just going back to eye movements, because some of the examples that I'm going to tell you about from the lab make heavy use of eye movement measures of reading, right? So just to illustrate to you how versatile eye movement measures of comprehension are, so imagine you present people a sentence like this. So we measured how people read the target area of a sentence. And now what do we do when we read sentences like this? Well, the eye just sort of moves around naturally, right? You start from left to right in English. And let's say you could see how when the eye gets to the target region of a sentence, these numbers here represent individual fixations, hypothetical fixations on a word, right? So the eye might fixate on the target once, it might fixate twice, the eye might go back and look earlier on in the sentence for a couple of fixations, it might then go back, it might move forward, it might regress again. So you could see the people do what they do when they read, right? Generally speaking, we go from left to right, but the eye also moves around. So given this naturalistic pattern of what people do when they're comprehending, we can parse up this record into different kinds of measures to get an idea of earlier versus later stage of language processing, right? So if I look at the very first time, the duration of time the eye lands on the word, that would be known as first fixation duration. If I look at the first couple of times, that's known as gaze duration. And then I could look at all the times, the duration of all the times the eye lands on the word, and that's known as total reading time. So that would be a more integrative measure of what people do when they read. So in a first study on bilingualism that really was initiated by my former student Maya Libin, we wanted to ask the question, how do bilinguals process words that overlap across languages? Okay, so we've done a couple of studies using materials of this kind. So we focused on words that overlapped across languages, right? So for those of you who speak English and French know, or any two languages know, there are some words that have perfect overlap across languages. Those are known as cognates, and there are some words that have some overlap across languages. They might have orthographic form overlap. They might visually look the same across languages, but they may mean completely distinct things. And those are known as homographs. So we took words like this because these types of words were really well studied in the bilingual literature, as I'm sure all of you in this room know. And we know that generally the finding is that homographs lead to slower processing times, whereas cognates lead to faster processing times. So we were interested in examining to what extent can a semantic context push these effects around in a natural reading situation. So we had interlingual homographs, our cognates. We created sentences that created a high semantic constraint. These are backwards. I flip them all the time. I'm sorry. So here we had a high semantic constraint and a low semantic constraint. So, for example, since they really liked each other, they had an extended chat that lasted all night. Since they really liked to gossip, they had an extended chat that lasts all night. So you could see how in one sentence situation, the context is pushing you towards the English language meaning and is excluding the other language meaning, whereas in the other kind of sentence is not. And then we did that for match control words. We did that for cognates and match control words, right? So we wanted to see how flexible the system is. And the standard finding that we got was if you look at early measures of reading, so here's fixation duration, here's the homographs, here are the cognates. Here's the high constraint sentences and the low constraint sentences, and the same over here. You could see that For homographs, the blue bars, which represent the target, are slower than the orange bars, which represent the control language unique words. Okay, so we have interference and interference for homographs and facilitation for cognates, which is what we would expect. But what was more interesting is the context didn't change that early on. But the context did change that later on, okay? So you could see that when the context was high, the interference went away, and when the context was high, the facilitation went away, okay? So this is interesting. It suggests that the bilingual mind is very flexibly organized. We did follow-up studies with homographs and cognates where, again, so this is what I just showed you, L2 readers spend more time fixating homographs for these types of words. L2 readers use context to attenuate these effects. We did a study with L1 readers showing that when people read in their L1, if they're bilingual, that they show similar but less profound effects on the homographs. Gotcha. And but the more interesting thing is that bilinguals with greater cognitive control capacity in our recent work show smaller interference effects for homographs, but individual differences in inhibitory control don't relate to cognates, okay? So again, getting at this question of what's the link between individual differences in cognitive control and bilingual language processing, it seems that there's a link when the particular language task at hand requires reducing conflict, but not in the case of cognates where there is no conflict, right? So we've done, I have to move now quickly, we've done other studies. With Veronica Whitford, we're doing studies looking at language-unique words, looking to see how to L1 and L2 language processing, how does that differ for just language-unique words, and we find reliable differences as a function of L2 exposure, which I can't go into right now because I've run out of time. And we're also doing this with language production, using eye movements with Irina Pivnova, and having people basically rename a picture array, so the doll and the carriage are above the cherry, and then we can co-register the eye movements with the speech onset to get an idea of planning effects. And again, here, I'm going to race through this, we find that individual differences in executive control relate to these measures. Okay? Just again, to highlight some of the other student work in my lab, Julie Mercier, we're looking at bilingual spoken word processing in younger and older adults. With Naveed Sheikh, we're looking at L1 and L2 emotional word processing. And Naveed and Irina have presentations at the Mental Lexicon conference that perhaps you guys could catch if you're going. And we have some new students in the lab, Annie Gilbert and Georgie Columbus, who are postdocs, and we're looking at other aspects of bilingual language processing with them, looking at acoustic realization of speech production and formulaic language in bilinguals. Okay? So the bottom line, knowing and using multiple languages, we believe, changes how bilinguals use language-unique words, requires cognitive control to the extent there is conflict, which is the putative mechanism of bilingual advantages, and we believe cognitive control is important for comprehension and production, and that what is unique to bilinguals, suppression of a whole linguistic system or perhaps grammatical co-activation, may be what really differs bilinguals from the monolingual case, right? So we're really thinking hard about how does bilingual language processing, what are the facets of bilingual language processing that are truly unique from monolingual? And perhaps that would be the area that might make bilinguals behave somewhat differently than monolinguals. Thank you. Do I have time for questions? 2 minutes for questions, I'm told. Yes.
The last, we'd follow from your last statement there that language, that bilinguals in languages that are have very different grammar would be very different from bilinguals with language with similar grammars, or has that been looked at?
I think some people have looked at that, but not closely enough, in my opinion. Like, I think that that's a really potentially exciting area of investigation. One thing I'm interested in is looking at where grammatical structures overlap and don't overlap across languages. And some languages, as you say, are profoundly different in grammatical structure, and others are similar with some variations on a theme. So I think the literature really substantiates the idea that how specific languages differ from each other are going to be directly relevant to the amount of cognitive control you need to keep one down at the expense of the other, right? So that's an excellent point and something that we're interested in. Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to the next. Okay. Okay. All right. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jeanette Van Hel, who's going to be speaking to us about contextual triggers.
Thank you. So I would like to talk about code switching today. And code switching can be seen as a hallmark of bilingual discourse. It's actually one of the very few natural phenomena that overtly reveal that bilinguals, two languages, are always active. And we know that people who code switch are not simply lost in translation. Linguistic research has shown us there are actually all kinds of structural regularities underlying code switching, a little bit like what you refer to as code mixing children. But from a more psychological point of view, the merging of two languages into a meaningful utterance actually provides us information about the flexibility of human speech. It also demonstrates a high level of cognitive control, exactly because these mixed utterances are never random. However, if we look in the literature, the cognitive studies that have looked at language switching typically present unrelated items in isolation. So this is an example of a study. So typically people are presented with consecutive trials, so you see a number on the screen, and then the border around the number indicates in which language you have to produce, in this case, a number, but it could also be a picture. So, for example, if a bilingual first has to present, has to speak out loud the number 6 in English, 1 in English, then has to switch to the other language and speak out loud the number 5 in French, for example. And then the idea is that the time it takes to go from a switch trial to a non-switch trial is compared. Oh, I'm sorry. Yep. Is it on?
Yes.
So a typical pattern that is found is that switching takes time. So what you see here is the response latencies on the non-switch trials and the switch trials, and what you can see is that it takes, people need more time to switch to the other language. And research has also shown that switching costs asymmetric. So basically, it takes more time to switch into the first language than it takes to switch into the second language. So we know that switching costs take time. Apparently, our system is less flexible than we would like it to be. But the true question is really what factors affect these language switching costs. So what triggers a switch into the other language? And that's a question that we're starting to examine in our lab. Code switching has been studied in the linguistic literature quite a bit, and there's a wealth of linguistic theories out there that try to describe the structural aspects of code switching. And one of the theories that actually comes quite close to cross-language interactions is a triggering theory, which has originally been proposed by Klein. So Klein argued that code switches are more likely to occur near trigger words. And trigger words are, for example, cognates in a lingual homographs or socio-contextual words or phrases. And this theory has basically been developed on the basis of a corpus analysis of code switches. So the quantitative support of the triggering theory argues that words in a clause containing a trigger word are more likely to be code switched than words in a clause without a trigger. And this has been tested in corpus data of, for example, 3 Dutch Moroccan Arabic bilingual speakers, and also in a transcript of 24 minutes of conversation with 1 bilingual speaker. So what we're trying to do is to test a triggering hypothesis in the lab. I have to stand here because I can't read the... So what we're trying to do is to use experimental methods in order to get a better handle at code switching behavior. And what we also like to do is to look at code switches in more meaningful context. So we're looking at code switches when they appear in sentences. And the question that we address is whether a trigger affects the perception or the production of code switches. And specifically, do triggers reduce code switching costs? So this work basically spans lab work across two different continents. So I moved to Penn State last year, and before that I was on the faculty in the Netherlands. So we started out with some studies in the Netherlands, and we continued this type of research in the U.S. So one study that looks at lexical triggering in perception is a study presented by Kate Litkowski at the Mental Lexicon on Thursday. And today I would like to focus on one study in which we looked at socio-contextual triggers in perception, and that's a study that we formed with Caitlin Ting, who's up there. And I would like to discuss a study in which we looked at production and looked at lexical triggering, and that's a study that we conducted in the Netherlands. So basically what we're trying to do is to connect linguistic theories that have been developed to describe code switching at a more structural level with psycholinguistic theories on language production. So in the first study, we wondered whether socio-contextual triggers can influence code switching. In other words, are code switches more likely to occur following a congruent socio-contextual trigger than an incongruent socio-contextual trigger? So we basically had two identical sentences. So Carla got home from the airport in Bogota. She wanted to tell her boss that her avion had arrived safely. And we had sentences that were identical, only in this particular case, the code switch was preceded by a socio-contextual trigger that was congruent with the language of the code switch. Whereas in this particular case, the socio-contextual trigger was incongruent with the language of the code switch. And this is just one example. Other examples are, for example, so these were the socio-contextual context that were then followed by a sentence that included a code switch. So in this particular case, if the code switch was into Spanish, then a Spanish word, then Spanish was congruent with the Spanish word, and the American was incongruent. And we had all kinds of different socio-contextual triggers. A second question we addressed was whether the pattern of processing times for code switches would vary according to the language environment the bilinguals were immersed in. So we basically had three groups of Spanish-English bilinguals. One group were Spanish-English bilinguals recruited at Penn State, so they were not really immersed in a Spanish-speaking community. We had a second group of bilinguals who came from the University of Texas, El Paso, who were immersed in a Spanish-speaking community. And we had a third group of Spanish-English bilinguals from the University of Tarragona in Spain, who were Spanish-speaking learners of the second language, English. These are the proficiency measures. So we collected English Boston naming and Spanish Boston naming data. And what you can see is that the Penn State Spanish-English bilinguals and the El Paso Spanish-English bilinguals perform similarly on the English Boston naming task and the Spanish Boston naming task. The people tested in Tarragona were more proficient on the Spanish Boston naming task and less proficient on the English Boston naming task, what you would expect. We gave them a self-paced reading task. So basically, in the first sentence was presented in full on the screen, and that sentence contained a socio-contextual trigger. And then they had to press a button one by one so that the next word would appear. So this would look like this. So this was the a sentence containing a socio-contextual trigger. And then they would have to go through the sentence like that. And what we measured were reading times. So the reading times are plotted on the y-axis. These are the reading times to the switch One word before the switch, two words before the switch. One word after the switch, two words after the switch, three words after the switch. And the blue line are the incongruent trials, and the purple line are the congruent trials. So what you can see is before the code switch, basically the reading times are similar across the two different sentences. But what you see is that across all three different populations, the switching cost is smaller after having read the congruent sentence containing the social contextual trigger. So if you break it down by the three different participant groups, what you see is that the effect was actually mainly driven by the Spanish-English bilinguals living in El Paso. So all three bilinguals show the same effect. It was just that the magnitude of the effect was larger in the El Paso bilinguals. And here are the Penn State participants and the Tarragona participants. So they all show a similar pattern. It's only that the magnitude of the triggering effect differed across the three different populations. So what can we conclude on the basis of this experiment? Social contextual triggers can facilitate the perception of code switches, but the magnitude of the triggering effect seems to be related to the specific environment the bilinguals live in. So in the second production study, we looked at lexical triggering. And the question that we addressed was, to what extent is a bilingual's likelihood to code switch affected by the presence of a lexical trigger in the utterance that he or she had to produce? And a lexical trigger, in this particular case, were cognates of false friends. The false friends being interlingual homophones. And the specific question we addressed was whether form overlap alone would be sufficient to facilitate triggering to the other language, or does lexical triggering only occur when there's both a form and a meaning overlap across two different languages? In that particular case, you would expect that cognates would induce a triggering effect and false friends would not. A second question we addressed was whether the presence of a code switch in the locutor's prevent utterance would affect the likelihood that the person would code switch into the other language. In other words, is a bilingual more likely to code switch after his or her discourse partner has also code switched? And this question was actually driven by the alignment model that has been proposed in the monolingual literature. So we know that if you put two people together, then they tend to align to each other. So they take over each other's words, they take over each other's syntactic structures, and they even take over each other's accents or other phonological features. And we wondered whether people would also take over each other's code switches. So can you adapt this model to a bilingual discourse situation? So we used the confederate scripted picture matching task. So basically we had two participants in the lab, but only one was a true participant. The other one was a confederate, was actually our helper. And this confederate was instructed to produce language in a particular way. But the naive participant had no idea that the other participant was actually our helper. So this confederate was instructed to code switch on specific trials. The participant, the true participant, was completely free to use any language he or she would like to use. An independent variable was simply whether or not the participant code switched in her picture description. So the idea is as follows. The confederate sees a particular picture on the screen, describes the picture in the way we want her to describe it, and then the true participant has to select one of the two pictures, and then the true participant sees her own picture and has to describe it. And the question is, if the confederate uses a lexical trigger and a code switch, would it affect the true participant's production behavior? So these were our different conditions. So the confederate could switch or not. And then the participant's picture could either contain a cognate, a false friend, or a control word. This is an example of one particular condition. In this particular condition, the confederate had switched, and the participant saw a picture with a cognate. So these are all Dutch-English bilinguals. So the confederate's turn was, for example, the oma pakte gitaar from the table, so switched to the other language after a cognate guitar, which is a cognate with a guitar. So the grandma takes the guitar from the table. And then the participant's next turn was to describe this picture in which grandma takes a baby from the couch. And baby is a cognate with Dutch. So in this particular case, the confederate had switched, and then the participant had to produce this, a picture description that contains a cognate item. So these are the findings. On the y-axis is the percentage of switches of the participant. If the confederate had not switched, the participant didn't switch. Only when the confederate had switched, oh, these are the control items, so the non-trigger items. So if the confederate hadn't switched, the participant didn't switch. If the confederate had switched, the participant was a little bit likely to switch. So what's the lexical triggering effect? There it is. So remarkably, even in cases when the picture contained a lexical trigger, if the confederate hadn't switched, the participant would not switch either. Only when the confederate had switched did we see this lexical triggering effect. And this difference was significant, and this difference was significant, and there was no significant difference between cognates and false friends. So as long as there was some form of overlap present in one of the items, this, we see a triggering effect. So the conclusion, lexical triggers in production, bilinguals were more likely to switch after a lexical trigger, but only when their interlocutor had also done so. And both cognates and false friends can function as lexical triggers. So form overlap alone is sufficient for language ambiguous words to serve as trigger. And these are the, this is the Penn State lab, and this is the Dutch lab.
Thank you.
Do you think that the triggering effects that you see might be different if you had people globally primed for one language or the other? Like, I assume that they would get smaller depending on the background level of other language activation, or?
In a way, you would predict that. I think that the trigger effect would decrease after prior exposure to a particular language, because then the trigger stands out less clearly. Yeah.
Oh, question? Sort of relatedly, do you figure that the reason that they only code-switched after the Confederate was code-switching was that it established like a social context in which code-switching was considered allowable, or that it actually cued them to do it in a different way?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So first off, I think that this study shows that the lexical triggering theory basically only functions in a discourse and situation, at least in language production. That said, the Dutch-English bilinguals are not your habitual code switchers. So we're now trying to replicate the study in the near future by testing Spanish-English participants who are more habitual code switchers to see the extent to which the confederate or the interlocutor has a very specific effect.
Thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Natalie Phillips from Concordia University. And let me get
the clicker. Great, well, thank you, everyone, and thanks very much to Deb and to the CRBLM, or Cerebellum, for organizing this workshop. I've really been looking forward to it. A lot of the work I'm going to present in the next few minutes comes from the doctoral thesis of Shana Kuse, who is home with her two-week-old baby, and she wisely chose not to come today. So I'm going to tell you briefly about studies that examine two different domains of executive control in monolinguals and bilinguals. The first group of studies, which are from Shana's dissertation, look at the extent to which monolinguals and bilinguals differ in their resistance to interference using tasks that are very common in this literature, the Stroop, the Simon, and Erickson tasks. And we're using reaction time and event-related brain potentials as our primary dependent variables. And we're comparing younger and older participants. And then if I have time, I'll very quickly tell you about a switching study. So I've got lots of great friends and colleagues, but these happen to be the ones in particular who I like to talk to about bilingualism. Here's Shanna, who's a lot of the data you're going to be hearing about, and then a number of very good colleagues and students who I enjoy working with on our collaborations in bilingualism. So, as we know from the preceding talks, there is a general view that bilingualism can confer a benefit on executive control. And this is largely due to the idea that attention and executive control is thought to be required to help a bilingual monitor and manage the use of their two languages. And this is thought to help a bilingual keep their two languages from interfering with each other. And there's a number of paradigms that have been used to look at this, some task switching work, language switching work, and in the next few minutes, I'll highlight tasks that involve resistance to interference, the Stroop, the Simon, and the attention network task. And a lot of this work has come out of Ellen Bialystok's lab, but there are also other researchers as well who have focused on this question. This is the question that Deb suggested was really hard to study, and I wish I'd met her earlier because it is. apart from the behavioral data, neuroimaging studies have also tried to tackle the question as to whether there's a bilingual advantage. And often what we see in these studies, using a variety of different methods, MEG, fMRI, and so on, is that it's not uncommon to see that there aren't behavioral advantages. So there aren't differences between a monolingual and bilingual in how they resolve these tasks. But there's almost always a difference in the brain response. So I think regardless of whether there's an actual advantage, there are certainly differences in how monolinguals and bilinguals approach these tasks. We have some data on this issue. And what we used were the tasks that are very commonly found in the literature. So the Stroop task, where you have to, in the incongruent condition, you have to name the color of this ink but ignore the color of the conflicting word. In the Simon task, you have to press a button according to its location on the screen, according to its color, but its physical location conflicts with its spatial location. And in the flanker task, you have to press a left or a right button to the center's target and ignore the flankers, which are pointing, giving you opposite spatial information. So all of these have been conceptualized as tasks that are necessary in this condition for you to suppress the competition from the irrelevant parts of the stimulus. We used ERPs in addition to behavioral measures because a number of these components have been linked to stages of cognitive processing. So these are responses that are recorded from the EEG, their average responses, and these are reflecting mass cortical electrical activity from the human brain. And so really tell you in the next slide, we're looking at a number of components. So if we consider a triggering stimulus, let's say a stimulus that that has conflict in it, there are a number of classical ERP responses or deflections in the waveform that are elicited. Might be helpful if you see this. If we look at a stimulus onset and we look at the change in electrical voltage pattern over time, we see a pattern of negative and positive going activity. And these discrete components reflect different aspects of cognitive processing. So the N2 component has been linked to aspects of conflict monitoring. It should be larger when conflict is present compared to a non-conflicting stimulus. The P300 has, its amplitude has been linked with the allocation of resources in a cognitive task, and its timing or latency reflects how quickly you can identify a stimulus as being meaningful or not. Excuse me. Of course, reaction times reflect also the endpoint of the interference between congruent and incongruent trials. And we can also look at another response, ERP response that comes after a behavioral response referred to as the error-related negativity, and that's elicited when you make an error on a task and is also sensitive to the detection that you've performed an error when your intention had been to perform accurately. So our hypotheses are that bilinguals would be advantaged in the performance of these tasks, and these advantages would also be reflected in the ERP components, and depending on which one on which they're advantaged might give us some insight as to which stage of processing might be advantaged in the bilinguals. So our predictions is that the bilinguals would be advantaged on the N2, which would reflect aspects of conflict monitoring. They would be better able to detect conflict during an incongruent trial. For the P300, we hypothesized that bilinguals would have larger P3s showing fewer resources that had to be allocated and earlier latencies. In terms of the responses, we assumed that the bilinguals would show a reaction time advantage on specifically on incongruent trials that have conflict. And then in terms of the ERN, we assumed a larger ERN showing that the bilinguals would be more sensitive, better able to monitor and detect an error when they committed it. So, of course, we didn't really think they were going to be different on every single thing, but this is what the predictions would be. So throughout the rest of the talk, just keep an eye on whether there's an X or a check mark. A check mark means that the bilinguals are advantaged specifically on the trials in which there's conflict, which is what the hypothesis would predict. And an X meant either equivocal or an opposite finding. So for the young adults that we tested here, sorry, these are young French, English, English-French bilinguals, we see that on the three tasks, reaction time was faster for a congruent trial than an incongruent trial, so that tasks are working. But there were no language groups differences in terms of the reaction time effects. So they were not, the bilinguals were not advantaged in terms of the monolinguals in resolving conflict. The ERP results are too many to tell you about, so I'll just skip to the pluses or the X's and X's and checks. And what you'll see is that there were remarkably few points at which the hypothesis held in the young adults. So the there didn't seem to be an advantage for the bilinguals in terms of conflict monitoring, in terms of error monitoring, none in the reaction time, as I mentioned. But there was a finding that the bilinguals had earlier P300s than the monolinguals. At this point, there wasn't strong evidence for an advantage in terms for the bilinguals, but we wondered whether there might be a ceiling effect. These are young adults, and they're at the top of their game, so to speak, in terms of having good executive control. So we ran the same study again with older adults. Basically, we're asking, will the predictions obtain, and might there be a different pattern for the older adults who do have more room to show an advantage if there is one? These are roughly 18 and 22 monolinguals and bilinguals. So what we have here is a slightly stronger pattern. The Simon and Flanker tasks, bilinguals were faster overall than the monolinguals. Specifically, there was an advantage for the bilinguals on the Stroop interference task, but then there was an opposite advantage for the monolinguals on the Simon interference task. And in terms of the ERPs, again, somewhat more evidence for an advantage, again, on the P3, and there's that reaction time advantage that I'd mentioned earlier. I don't have time to talk about this, so I'll just go to the general conclusions. So I think there's variable evidence for bilingual advantage in executive control. I think in terms of conflict monitoring, I think that the strongest evidence is, without question, there's differences in how monolinguals and bilinguals approach these tasks, and I think those differences are very interesting. Whether they prove to be an advantage or not may not be true for younger adults who are at the top of their game, but may turn out to be an advantage for older adults. We did have some evidence from the task switching study that bilinguals were advantaged relative to the monolinguals. There are some methodological considerations I think that we have to think about in the literature in terms of study design, in terms of whether there's a bilingual advantage. These effects can be rather fragile or ephemeral. When they're reported earlier in experimental designs rather than later. So it may have to do with whether monolinguals are able to catch up after enough trials. But I also think there's some interesting differences, non-trivial differences, between our participant samples, between whether bilinguals are coming from immigrant samples, as they are in some research cohorts, or are non-immigrant samples that we're fortunate to have in Montreal. And I think these are not trivial differences, and I think they're interesting ones. I mean, we can discuss differences in terms of socioeconomic status, diet, stress, life history differences, but also this contextualized use of language that Janet was just referring to, kind of the behavioral ecology of the bilingual speaker in Green's parlance. And I think the interesting question, as Deb alluded to as well, how is it that a bilingual uses their language and manages their two languages, and to the extent that we can understand those differences, I think we'll get a better handle on whether there are advantages or not in terms of cognitive control. We have future directions. We're going to, but I'll leave those for now, and I'll stop and take questions. Thank you.
Just a methodological question. How bilingual were the bilinguals?
They're highly proficient bilinguals, yeah. And we've been using Norman's task of animacy judgment to also look at variability in the L1 and L2 performance. So they're not simultaneous, but they tend to be early sequential bilinguals.
Okay. Other questions?
Have you looked at all at the other variables, how perhaps the ways that your bilingual sample differs in SES or even L2 proficiency and things like this, how that relates to those tasks?
So because they're high proficient bilinguals, okay, we tend not to have enough variability to look at, okay, whether there's variation in the bilinguals as a function of their L2. We have cognitive measures on the monolinguals and the bilinguals, and to the extent that we can match them on those variables, and they are. And we also have those measures for the older monolinguals and bilinguals. So in other respects, they're as well matched as we can make them, understanding that, you know, we are comparing very different groups.
Okay, yeah. One last question in the back.
You did not find an N2 effect for the bilinguals, the young bilinguals, nor the older adults. And Tamara Golan recently has been doing some correlational studies between language conflict tasks and general domain conflict tasks. And mm-hmm. The question is really, if you think that the mechanism is the same, then you should find correlations. And right. She's presented some work that suggests that they don't correlate. And what's interesting is that other ERP researchers who do these tasks that have language conflict, like phonological overlap between the two languages when you're in a monolingual mode, causes N2 effects. My question is whether if you could correlate ERP tasks with language conflict with the domain general tasks that you've been using.
Yeah.
Would you expect a correlation or not, and why that might not be?
So that's a really good question. Now, the N2 effects are there in the sense that both groups show N2, bigger N2s to an incongruent trial than a congruent trial. It's just that there's no difference in the magnitude of that effect. Now, with respect to whether the mechanisms for handling language conflict are the same as more generalized conflict resolution, the study that I got that I skipped over suggests, at least in the task switching domain, this wasn't with ERPs, but with monolinguals, we had a task. We had two tasks. One which was reflected general aspects of task switching with relatively non-linguistic stimuli, and then a task that forced people to switch between highly grammaticized or relational aspects of language. And in monolinguals, those switching costs are very distinct from each other, and it's harder to do the language switching task. They're not switching between languages, but they're switching between aspects within a language. In the bilinguals, the costs come down, so that's where they show an advantage, and then those costs become correlated. So yes, we do think that they, in bilinguals, there's at least some evidence that these start to converge on a common mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, last in our session is Dr. Howard Trico.
How do I advance it?
Just you push this button there, and then here's okay.
I'm even starting a timer here, so I'm known. Thanks to Deborah, and this is fun. This is a nice, interesting workshop. I'm delighted to be here. I'm looking forward to Professor Kroll's talk. So I'm going to switch things a little bit. We're going to go from sophisticated task testing executive function to doctors asking questions to patients in the memory clinic. And what I'm going to focus on is Alzheimer's disease and this new, very interesting area of cognitive reserve tested with the onset of dementia in people with Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is now viewed as a chronic disease, which has a start. These things never seem to like me. Am I doing it? Oh, I'm using the other one. All right. I would have figured that out. Yeah. Has a start sometime, probably decades before we see the patients, and clinical symptoms appear, and finally, at some arbitrary point, they come to a memory clinic and are diagnosed as having dementia. What this means is that for perhaps your whole life, you have things giving an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, genetic predispositions, folding going on in proteins and brain cells and other damage to the brain. And you have protective factors, some genetic and nutritional going back to childhood, and building brain reserve or, more importantly, cognitive reserve during your life. So these are protective and anti-protective factors. Recently, there's been a whole list of protective factors suggested, things which slow down the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And I'm not going to go through what these are, but a lot of these are nutritional and medications, things like that. Exercise, mental stimulation, leisure activities, particularly line dancing. I highly recommend line dancing to everybody. And education. So basically, we're viewing that there are four ways you can modify when you get Alzheimer's disease. It seems to be increased brain reserve capacity from prenatal and childhood factors, building cognitive reserve, and that's what we're focusing on here, compensatory processes, we really don't understand those, nutritional factors or medications or other treatments that might slow the disease during life. And what is cognitive reserve? This is a whole lecture, and Jakob Stern in Colombia has made this great career out of exploring this notion, which we really don't have a handle on what it is. I've talked about things in the brain that's like the hardware, better hardware in your brain, or cognitive reserve in dealing with environmental factors, which is, we don't know, improving the software or also affecting the hardware, things that seem to stimulate the brain and coping with damage using pre-existing processes or compensatory processes. There are proxies for cognitive reserve, and what we are talking about here are things which seem to correlate or be part of this concept, socioeconomic status, income, high occupation, more literacy or education, IQ, better executive function, leisure activities, and bilingualism is now getting on the list, and this is why I'm invited here today. I'll show you just one slide just to show you the flavor of the sorts of things we're looking at, that you can get imaging evidence for cognitive reserve in the following way. You can look at patients with Alzheimer's disease and look at their amyloid load in their brain, and you can compare Alzheimer's patients with high education and low education who have the same degree of dementia. And if you do that, and this has been done in a study like such as this, same severity of dementia, the highly educated group had more amyloid on PIB-PET imaging compared to the lower educated group. Here's a nice picture. So this is comparing groups of patients. There's more amyloid in the brains of those with higher education. In other words, they've got more disease load to give them the same degree of dementia because they've got cognitive reserve built into their brain. So this is something that can be looked at in education or in bilingualism. So the main factor that's been looked at for cognitive reserve is educational level, but there have been a number of papers exploring the idea of bilingualism as another way to build your cognitive reserve, and this has been a Canadian subject largely, so it's nice to do this here in Canada. The idea that bilingualism is doing cognitive work, you're having a second language acquisition, maybe this builds cognitive reserve. Is it different if you learn it at a young age or adulthood? We don't know that. But again, Alan Bialystok in Toronto at York has carved out this area in her work in bilingualism. She started a collaboration with Morris Friedman at Baycrest in his clinic and Dr. Craik down there as well. And what she did was go through the files in Morris Friedman's very large memory clinic, look at the age of diagnosis of dementia in a large cohort, and published this. They had like 228 patients, but really 184 diagnosed with dementia. About half were bilingual and about half were not. And they found a 4.1 years difference between the age at which they were diagnosed as dementia in the bilinguals. They were diagnosed later than the unilinguals. Well, we read this study in our lab and had a journal club and just sat there and complained about the study for a few hours and decided, you know, we had the same data. We could try and replicate or de-replicate this study. But what we were unhappy about, of course, is that, first of all, they lumped all sorts of things together. People who spoke more than two languages versus two languages. Most importantly, it was Toronto, so the bilingual people were all Italian and Jewish immigrants we're talking about Baycrest Hospital, so we're talking about Jewish immigrants who had, many of them, gone through the Holocaust and wars in Europe and then immigrated to Toronto, compared to unilingual Torontonians from Rosedale. And to have these two groups and say the only difference is that one speaks more than one language and the other group speaks one language seemed a little naive to us. Also, there's such a problem in assessing onset of memory loss, and the time at which you diagnose dementia is so arbitrary, largely depends on the waiting list to get into the memory clinic. So all of these things led us, and also they looked at dementia and not Alzheimer's disease, so we were upset about that. They did, however, continue after this publication, and there's a follow-up study where they focused just on Alzheimer's disease dementia, and they found the same thing. So now he's getting a little more convinced here, 100 versus 100. Again, 4.3 years difference. The bilingual Alzheimer's disease diagnoses were 4.1 years later than the unilingual ones. They did a third study, which I'm not going to discuss because it's so problematic. You can ask me about it, but where they looked at MCI. Basically, they put an ad in the paper, had people come in, diagnosed them as mild cognitive impairment, and looked at how old the people were who answered their ad when they walked in through their door. But they found the same sort of difference, only in the pure MCIs who have memory problems with no other cognitive domain. So it's not a very good study. And then they did this fourth study, with 20 bilingual and 20 unilingual Alzheimer's patients where they looked at CAT scans and applied an imaging methodology nobody has used for 25 years, and they found that the bilingual Alzheimer's patients had more temporal lobe atrophy, medial temporal atrophy, than the unilingual ones. Remember I showed the amyloid scans? They're using the same sort of technique and saying, the amyloid scans I showed you were in high and low education groups. They're saying the bilinguals are like high education. They have more disease in their brain to give them the same level of dementia. So all of these, it's a set of studies, and actually, well, what do these mean? Just looking at the here, that they said that they thought it was causative and not just association, that somehow bilingualism was producing cognitive reserve, compensation, or modifying the disease progress. So our response was to look at our data, and what we did was in a paper with myself and Natalie Phillips, and who did a lot of the work with her team, and Howard Bergman and Christina Wolfson, we looked for a database where we've got a large set of multilingual immigrants and bilingual and multilingual Canadians, because we live in a wonderful city where people born here, are many of them are bilingual and some are not. We looked through 632 patients in our database where we had age of dementia diagnosis and documentation of their language. We don't have documentation of the age at which they learned their second language. It's very hard to get that data. But we also had 143 where we knew exactly the age at which their memory problems had begun. So we looked at these things together. The first analysis just looked at all of the unilinguals versus all of the multilinguals, that's more than one language, and the age of diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. There's a slight difference, but not the 4.1 years difference they found in Toronto. So this was not significant, it's just a trend. And they're about the same in terms of the amount of education and the severity of dementia at the time they were diagnosed. So what this meant, looking at the overall group, was there's a trend towards multilinguals being diagnosed later, but it was only a trend. Among the multilinguals, the number of languages spoken, however, did correlate with the age of diagnosis. And postdoc analysis shows that those who spoke four or more languages were diagnosed 4 years later. So two languages wasn't enough. Three or four appeared to make a difference. If we look at the organization by the number of languages spoken, obviously not that many people spoke four or more languages, but here you see the age of diagnosis starts to creep up from 76 to 80. And they were, you know, Gus Craik said, well, this is partial replication of what we did in Toronto. And it is partial replication. There's obviously some effect here of number of languages, but it doesn't become significant going from one to two. However, we looked at other things. We looked at the subgroup where we had reliable data on the age at symptom onset. And here we found that the language status did not delay the age of symptom onset. However, again, the number of languages correlates with the age of symptom onset. In other words, three or four languages did delay when you got your symptoms, this time by 5 years. So again, partial replication. And this is seen here, we'll skip over that one. We looked at the subset of people who were born in Canada, so get rid of this immigration here. And here we got no effect of languages. Now the bilinguals were being diagnosed earlier than the unilinguals, so that's the opposite of the effect seen in Toronto. However, and this is seen here, unilinguals, bilinguals, this is the age at diagnosis. So depending on how you look at the data, we're getting different effects. But then we looked at it this way, and actually I have to say it was Gus Craik, who was one of the reviewers, who said, why don't you split it up between the immigrants, the unilingual, the ones who are native Francophones, and the ones who are native Anglophones. So we did that, and now you do see something. Look at this. This is the number of languages, and this is the different groups. Look at the immigrants. As they go from unilingual to bilingual, we're getting a big difference in the age at which they're diagnosed as Alzheimer's disease, and that goes up if they speak three or four languages. The Canadian people who grew up speaking French and then learned English, we also get a difference between one and two languages and going up to three. But what is throwing off our whole group is look at the Anglophones. The unilingual Anglophones seem to have the same age at which they're diagnosed as Alzheimer's disease whether they speak one or two or three languages. And this is what seems to be distorting our data. So why do unilingual Anglophones seem to have some sort of protection in their brain compared to the other two groups? We looked at whether it was socioeconomic status. We had this data. It was not. We thought maybe they were all making more money than the unilingual Francophones. That didn't play out. So we're left with, there's some interesting element here, nutrition, stress, genetics, vascular risk factors, accounting for interesting differences between the different communities in the same city. Now, I have to say parenthetically that we wanted to have a press conference, and my hospital said, I don't think this is something we want to publicize, that the Jewish General Hospital is saying Anglo brains are better than Francophone brains. So, and as a last point, there was a study out of UCSD where it showed that the bilingualism benefit only, they found it in people with low education and not in high education. So cultural, gender, different communities, different education levels, I'm going to skip over this, can make a difference as well. So what do we conclude? Cognitive reserve in each individual appears to be a complex phenomenon. There are nature and nurture factors, intelligence, education, occupation, and bilingualism perhaps is one part of the puzzle. And what we feel is that cognitive reserve is complex, and learning language is one piece of the puzzle, one aspect of an individual's life which may be protective. And in the future, we need to pursue the questions, what can be done to increase cognitive reserve when we have to intervene? Can these interventions slow the Alzheimer's process? Can we encourage compensation? And is there any sort of synergy between future treatments to slow Alzheimer's disease and these all these elements that build cognitive reserve? So we have an exciting future in pursuing this area, and this will be one of the areas that is pursued, is the bilingualism question. And we will be looking at MRI scans in the next month, right, Dr. Phillips, to see if we get brain imaging data that falls in line with Toronto as well. Thank you very much, and these are our collaborators.
Okay.
Please.
Well, obviously the $64,000 question is, what do you think, is it something about the immigrants or something about the Anglos? But
I honestly don't know. I suspect, there's so many differences between, the smoking rate between unilingual Francophones and unilingual Anglophones, what they eat. I mean, the intake of poutine might be different, but it might be genetic factors. These are different genetic groups. So,
but the immigrant group showed quite dramatic improvements with a number of languages. So, and yet they were the least educated, relatively speaking. So.
Yeah, so it's intriguing and is certainly worth pursuing, but all I've got is a list of possibilities.
And the unilingual immigrant group wasn't different in SES from the other immigrant groups?
Well, we couldn't see statistically significant differences in SES between the three unilingual groups. We thought that would be the explanation, but that did not play out. And we simply don't have enough data on things like nutrition and vascular risk factors and so on.
And just a clarification question. I'm not sure I understood whether education was regressed out from the Montreal study.
Oh, that. The education did not explain the difference. I thought I showed that in one of the tables. So neither socioeconomic status or education, which are the two most likely factors, seem to be responsible for the differences.
Okay, one last question in the back there.
Great talk, Howard. Thanks. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the unilingual immigrants. So, are these people who have immigrated from New Zealand or Australia or England, or are these people who just came and didn't speak English or French?
So that's an interesting question. One could speculate, they came from all over, but one could speculate that, Sherry Baum the other day was saying The problem is, who are these unilingual people? The normal state is to be bilingual in a culture which is bilingual. How do you move from Italy and remain unilingual for 27 years? You know, is this reflecting? And you know, it may not play out. They all had basic education, but one could speculate that maybe such a person was more intellectually challenged than other people who did acquire the language, one of the two languages of the new country. So, and this might be reflected in the early age of onset of dementia. So the problem is we only have proxies for cognitive reserve. You know, I've met people in India who had very limited education who were highly intelligent and did very well in their testing. So I suspect that that little subgroup of people who moved from Europe and remain unilingual for many, many years may be at higher risk of dementia.
Okay. All right. So why don't we take a thank you very much. We have one more quick snack break, and then we'll come for Dr.